Hello, it's Monday, March the 1st, and you're listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. I'm Bill Whalen. I'm a research fellow here at the Hoover Institution, as well as the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. And if you're a regular listener to Hoover Podcast, my voice is familiar because I was your host for the Area 45 podcast. But once the election occurred and Donald Trump was no longer in office, Area 45 no longer seemed germane. So we figured a new title for the podcast, and that is now Matters of Policy and Politics. So while this is technically a new podcast, it's also a familiar podcast. And joining me for the maiden voyage in this, I can't think of a better partner to kick this off than my colleague Lanhee Chen, one of the most astute minds I know when it comes to matters of policy and politics. Lanhee, thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Bill. Very kind to have me on. Thank you.
Thanks. And just for the audience should know, in case you're not familiar with Lanhee, Lanhee is the Hoover Institution's David and Diane Steffi Research Fellow in American Public Policy Studies, and he's the Director of Domestic Policy Studies and lecturer in Stanford University's Public Policy Program. In 2012, Lanhee Chen was Policy Director for Mitt Romney's presidential campaign. In 2016, he advised the presidential effort of Florida Senator Marco Rubio. Lanhee, be honest here. Anytime you get a call from the 202 these days, does it go straight to voicemail, or are you assuming it's somebody who wants to talk about 2024?
No, it's a little early for that. Usually it ends up being one of these robocalls telling me that my social security benefits are in jeopardy. So that tends to be more than anything else. Any other calls I get from the 202 are actually prank calls, but it'll be an interesting next couple of years leading into 2024 to be sure.
Yeah, and I think it's actually kind of begun in this regard. Yesterday was Donald Trump's much anticipated, well, certainly anticipated, a media appearance before CPAC. Let me give you three takeaways from this, Lanhee, then I want to get your thoughts on this because you are you've had to deal with CPAC working for both Mitt Romney and Marco Rubio. My three takeaways from CPAC, Lanhee. Number one, the spectacle of a former president who won't leave the stage. This is something new to presidential politics. Former presidents, those who lose elections, one-term presidents, or what you know Douglas MacArthur said about old soldiers, they don't die, they just fade away. But not this former president. He seems determined to stay in the mix. Second point, Lanhee, we are all trying to guess what's on Donald Trump's mind, and who knows what's on his mind. Good luck trying to figure that. But then third, speculating on 2024, there's so much to play out. And CPAC, we always get caught up in the CPAC straw poll and what it means. Ask Ted Cruz what it means, because he won the CPAC straw poll in 2016. Ask Rand Paul what it meant, because I think he won it in 2013, 14, and 15. We get so worked up about an election that's very far away based on what a handful of people at an event in Orlando, Florida said. So your take on Trump and CPAC, Lanhee?
I think those takes are very good. I mean, I would just add a few thoughts. First of all, it was pretty clear that Donald Trump had a significant amount of support amongst the attendees at CPAC. But if you look at the actual outcome of whether it was a straw poll or other polling around the attendees of CPAC, there isn't unanimity by any means about Donald Trump being a presidential candidate again. I think that the percentage, for example, of straw poll respondents that wanted Trump to be the nominee in 2024 was something just a little over 50%, 55%, I think. And that's a lot smaller than the share of the overall electorate, the overall Republican electorate that thinks positively of Trump. So there is a little bit of a disconnect there that I think is worth exploring. And I think the other thing that's interesting is really how little time was spent, you know, to get to the title of your podcast and where you hope these conversations will go. Mm-hmm. How little was really discussed in terms of the vision for the conservative movement from a policy or substantive perspective going forward. Now, you can forgive some of that because it's a political conference above all, not a policy conference. Right. But, you know, it is intriguing because there are these splits and divisions within the conservative movement when it comes to the future of public policy and what the conservative movement will stand for, that you might have expected a little bit more of that conversation. We didn't really see it at CPAC. And then the last thing I'll say is that CPAC tends to be an opportunity for conservative politicians to break out of the pack. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, there was one guy who I really think it's worth paying attention to, and that's Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, right, who finished second to Trump in the CPAC straw polling. But also, I think in part because the event was held in Orlando in his state, but also because of the reaction that many conservatives have had to the COVID-19 related shutdowns, the fact that DeSantis has really tried to open Florida up and create as much of a business as usual environment has earned him the scorn of the mainstream media, right, but has also made him something of a conservative darling. And I think it's worth watching for where DeSantis' star goes from here, because I think in the grand scheme of governors and how they've played out in this crisis, those who seemed ascendant early, like Gavin Newsom of California and Andrew Cuomo of New York, have seen their stars fall precipitously in the last week or so. And people like DeSantis, who were reviled, have actually been vindicated to a certain degree. So that's someone who I would certainly keep an eye on looking ahead.
Yeah, by the way, trending on Twitter today, Lon, he is DeSnatis, because apparently when they did the tote board at CPAC and put up the results of the straw poll, they misspelled DeSantis. So DeSnatis is now trending, DeSnatis 2024.
Yeah, well, however he spells his name, however they spell his name, it is clear that he is someone who, at least as we sit here, March 1st of 2021,
right,
a full 3 years before the primaries are actually in full gear, DeSantis looks like somebody who could potentially get some traction as we work ahead here.
Yeah, one question here, Lonnie, is how the Republicans are going to grow the party. This is the perpetual four-year question. And that was another thing that struck me about CPAC, how the activists there just kind of glossed over this. They actually would have you believe that the Trump model is a pattern for Republicans moving forward. But if you do the math, it doesn't work out. So Donald Trump got 74.2 million votes in 2020, Lonnie, an improvement of about 11.2 million over 2016. But Joe Biden got 81.26 million, an improvement to 15.4. You're more of a policy brain than I am, and you're probably better at math than I am, but my crude mathematical skills, Lonnie, tell me that if the opposition's getting 15.4 million more votes and you're getting 11.2 million more, you're going to lose every election moving forward. So the question for Republicans, Lonnie, is how are they going to grow the party? How do you keep Trump people on board, but how do you also reach out to those groups of suburban women, college-educated voters who defected from Republicans during the Trump era?
Yeah, in my mind, Bill, it speaks to the importance of, for Republicans at least, articulating a governing vision rather than a vision that's so closely tied to personality, and in particular to a single personality. I think what you saw in the 2020 election was an artifact of the Republican Party being so closely tied and associated with one person. And that one person, Donald Trump, happened to be extremely polarizing. And as a result, what you get is you get a political environment where there is a referendum on a single person and a single personality. And yes, I understand that most re-election campaigns end up being referenda on the incumbent. That is certainly true. Right. But I think even more so this year, Bill, this really was a campaign that was premised on how do you feel about Donald Trump, not Donald Trump and what he's done in office, not the Abraham Accords, not deregulation, not the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, but what do you think of Donald Trump, the person? And for the Republican Party to be a successful governing coalition going forward that attracts more and more people, whether that coalition becomes increasingly minority, as some have argued it should, a minority working class, diverse coalition, which is kind of what Marco Rubio, for example, has articulated, right, or if it tries to double down on the so-called anxious white population, which is what some others have said, really there's more to be mined there. Whatever direction the party goes in, it seems pretty clear that it's not going to be able to do so successfully without articulating a set of principles and a set of policies on which it plans to govern. And that's something that I would hope party leaders understand, that it's untenable to continue to move ahead so closely tied to one person and one personality. That produces, in my mind, electoral disaster again and again. And so the outcome of the 2020 election is only the tip of the iceberg when you think about what's to come if it continues to be a movement based on personality rather than on policy.
Okay, so pop quiz question, Lonnie. Who leads the Republican Party right now?
Oh, well, that depends on who you ask. Clearly, the grassroots believe it's Donald Trump.
Right.
And, there's evidence to support that he is the most well-known. He is the most popular. He is the most desired and sought after speaker amongst, Republican audiences. So that's certainly one point of view. Mm-hmm. The other point of view is that it's Mitch McConnell. And Mitch McConnell is somebody who understands the political dynamic probably better than any other Republican, maybe better than any other politician in America right now. I wrote a column at CNN about a week and a half ago, Bill, that basically tries to explain, to get into the head of Mitch McConnell, why has he done the things he's done? And the argument I make is basically, look, it's all explainable from the perspective of McConnell trying to be in a position to be at the center of the conversation about where the Republican Party goes from here on out, whether it's on policy or from a political perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think McConnell is and has always been a lot more influential and a lot smarter than people give him credit for. And so I think, in my view, Mitch McConnell is still the most enduring and important Republican figure, not because he's the most popular, but because he understands better than anybody what the dynamic has to be if the Republican Party is to be electorally successful going forward. So in my mind, there's a split, but I give the slight edge to McConnell because I think he is just a better long-term tactician at the end of the day than is Donald Trump, who's an incredible showman, but fundamentally is not the kind of tactician that Mitch McConnell is.
A tactician in the Senate, Lon Heap, but what about in terms of a campaign and visionary tactician? I'm thinking Newt Gingrich in 1994, the contract with America. Do you see anybody in the GOP who can serve that kind of Newt-like role for 2022?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough question. I think that there are some very substantive Republicans in Congress, people who are very good in articulating elements of public policy, whether it's Rubio, Tom Cotton, we've talked about Ben Sasse in his own way, very different, obviously, in orientation from Cotton, and also from Rubio. You know, Mitt Romney has come back into the policy conversation as well. Mm-hmm. He obviously represents a portion of the party that is, you know, I think, admittedly, a lot smaller now than it was when he was nominee of the Republican Party to be president. And there are others on the House side. You know, there are some who are very good at articulating elements of public policy. And so I think there isn't somebody that occupies that single sort of place in the way that Newt did in the 1990s. But I also think that the politics of the time are very different than what they were then as well. And so it might not be something that falls to one person. It might be something that falls to multiple people within the movement to articulate what that policy vision looks like going forward. And perhaps you can argue, by the way, that's the problem the Republicans have, is that they don't have a single figure on policy who is able to sort of carry the mantle forward, kind of like Paul Ryan did. For right. some time, you know, Paul Ryan was sort of the muse of the conservative movement when it came to public policy for many, many years during his time in Congress, and he did so very ably. But when Paul left, there really wasn't someone to take that same mantle and pick it up and run with it.
I'm curious as to what you think Lon Heap Republicans should be talking about policy-wise. And I'll give you a good example, which is this $1.9 trillion COVID package, of which a very small amount actually deals with COVID. The rest of it's just kind of the dreams of, you know, Democrats who like to spend money. But yet you look at the polls, it polls very well. And the public, when it comes to debts and deficit, kind of bats its eye and just shrugs its shoulders and doesn't pay attention. So if you're a Republican trying to run on good government, trying to run on sensible fiscal management, Lon Heap, What are really your choices these days?
Yeah, I mean, the fiscal recovery package is a good example of where I do think Republicans have taken the right policy position, even though I think politically it is going to be a challenge. Look, you're absolutely right. About $160 billion of the $1.9 trillion is direct COVID relief. And by the way, Republicans, when they made a counteroffer to the Democrats a couple of weeks ago on this recovery package, included all of that $160 billion in their package as well. But the Democrats dismissed it out of hand because they realized that politically, they were going to push through a package that was filled with a lot of spending, filled with a lot of unnecessary assistance, frankly, that the data show really won't do a whole lot to help the economy recover faster or create jobs or do the things that we would want out of this kind of package. That really it's a giveaway to states that aren't run very well, right. First of all, and second of all, to provide a lot of untargeted assistance to people. And look, I suppose everyone loves free money, but at the end of the day, I think Republicans do have to make the argument that what we need now, after having done $4 trillion of stimulus last year, What we really need now is something that is targeted, that is intended to achieve the results that we want, which is to close some of this output gap we're seeing in our economy, right, and to try and continue to sustain momentum on reopening the economy and getting kids back in schools. Those are the kinds of priorities that Republicans ought to focus on. And they have focused on it. So in terms of the messaging, I think it's going to be crucial for Republicans to remind voters and to remind people that what we need to be doing now is building an economy and building a society that has longevity and that can last. And one of the challenges with all of this profligate spending in the $1.9 trillion package is that it puts that at jeopardy. It puts the livelihoods of people in, not even in the long run, in the intermediate run, we're going to start to see some of this debt and deficit that we're adding because of all this spending begin to come home to roost. That's the argument that has to be made. Now, it's not a very compelling argument when you compare that to we're going to give you free money. But it is an argument I think Republicans do have to make, and that side of the argument does have to be held up. And I do think it's the right time to be doing it. So there's no easy answer here, Bill. There's no political silver bullet, but it's the right set of arguments from a policy perspective to be making.
I guess you also have to let events play them out and see what opportunities arise. But let me ask you another question, vis-a-vis Republicans, Lonnie, and that's the question of the nemesis. Democrats have had a wonderful nemesis the past 4 years in Donald Trump, and they must delight when he goes to CPAC and gives a talk, because now they can talk about Trump and link Republicans to Trump. And we'll get to California in a minute and talk about the recall election out here. But, you know, mark my words, Donald Trump will be dragged into that election in some way. But if we look at Republicans, Lonnie, Nancy Pelosi right now, I guess, is your nemesis. I mean, Joe Biden is a very tricky target to go after. How would you make fun of Joe Biden? You'd probably go after his mental faculties. I'd be very careful going down that road. Making fun of Kamala Harris, well, suddenly you're going to get pushed back in terms of race. So it's Nancy Pelosi by default almost, but she said she's going to leave office after 2022. Believe it when I see it, but she said she's going to step down after 2022. Who do Republicans turn to as the boogeyman or the boogeywoman if Nancy Pelosi is not in Congress?
Well, this is a great question, Bill, and it's part of the reason why Democrats are so keen to continue talking about Donald Trump, because he unifies the Democratic movement. He provides, as you say, a target or bogeyman that Democrats can use to try and garner support. And Republicans don't have the same figure to go against. I think you're right. Biden, he doesn't raise people's blood pressure the way that Trump does. Nancy Pelosi used to, I think, but that target's getting a little bit old. Not to be pejorative about it, but you know, I think that target is just not one that has the same cachet it once had. You know, there's been talk that maybe you really try and play up the progressive side of the party, so that would be Bernie Sanders, but you know, probably more to the point about age and about longevity. People like AOC and Rashida Tlaib and others who are on the progressive side of the Democratic Party. You know, my sense is that works pretty well with conservative activists. I'm not sure how well it works with the ordinary American who might not even know who AOC is or might not be following it closely enough to have a great sense of disdain for those figures. So Republicans do have a little bit of a challenge in the sense that they don't have the same kind of figure around which to animate opposition as the Democrats do in Donald Trump, which, as I said earlier, is why they are incredibly eager to keep Donald Trump in the cycle. I mean, I fully imagine that over the next several years, even going into 2024, certainly if Trump continues to tease being involved in politics, it gives Democrats an excuse and a reason to continue to talk about Donald Trump and tie him to every single Republican running for office around the country.
Well, I think the Trump campaign in 2020, Lonnie, underscored your point. They did not talk much about first-term record. They didn't talk much about a second-term agenda, but they talked a lot about socialism. But at the end of the day, Joe Biden still won office, despite all the scares about socialism coming. So again, it just seems that the party is going to go out and just scare you about AOC and the oncoming advent of socialism in America. It doesn't seem voters are quite motivated by that.
Well, but that's true, I think, to a general degree. But the socialism argument worked in some parts of the country. Yeah, and I think it exposed the possibility that Republicans could build a coalition that was more diverse. For example, what we saw with the Cuban American population or the Hispanic population in South Florida, what we saw with some Hispanics in West Texas. There are definitely places where, you know, certain Asian American populations, there definitely are areas of the country where the anti-socialism, anti-communism sort of anti-big government message did work to the Republicans' advantage and does create a little bit of an opening potentially to build a durable sort of multicultural coalition going forward.
Okay, well put. Let's shift now to California, if you're willing. And I want to talk both about the recall election, but also the next elections in 2022. I'm a transplant to California, Lonnie. I came out here in 1994 and I've worked for Pete Wilson, stayed here ever since, but you're a native, correct?
That is correct. I grew up in Southern California. I grew up east of LA and spent a good deal of my childhood in Southern California and have been back here now for the last several years. So I'm kind of a native who returned.
You're a native who returned. You also belong to a community in California, Asians who are overlooked politically, I would contend. I would say for you, California's plight is probably much more personal than it is for me. So let's first of all talk about the recall, Lonnie. What strikes me about this, very easy to say, well, the more things change, the more they remain the same. If we have a recall election in 2021 to decide the fate of Gavin Newsom, it's very much the same as in 2003 with Gray Davis. But I would point out a couple of differences here, Lonnie. Number one, no Arnold Schwarzenegger or no Schwarzenegger-like character who could come in and sort of hijack the election, turn it into much more of a media circus, if you will. Just remember Arnold going out and wrecking balls on cars and, you know, shooting T-shirts into crowds and things like that, really kind of turning it into like a movie production, if you will. Secondly, Lonnie, with Arnold in the race in 2003, it was much more jocular. And I think in a state that has serious economic issues, serious COVID problems, jocularity is not the order of the day. Thirdly, Lonnie, I think it'll be much more personal against Gavin Newsom than it was against Gray Davis. Personal, I mean, you know, Gavin Newsom was on Saturday Night Live. He was mocked on Saturday Night Live, I should correct. He had another run-in at a restaurant over the weekend at a Mexican restaurant in Fresno, a question whether or not he dined indoors. So we're back in the French Laundry turf. I think if you run against Newsom in the recall, not you, but if somebody runs against Newsom in the recall, it's going to be much more character inviting than it was in 2003. But then finally, in Here's where I want to get your thoughts, Lonnie. The conversation about government that may or may not occur in 2021. Schwarzenegger, shortly before the election in 2003, went to Sacramento and gave a speech about the need for government reform, as he famously called it, blowing up the boxes. It was a very thoughtful speech, well-written. Some of our Hoover colleagues were involved in it. There was a lot of deep thought put into it, a lot of very good ideas. Then Arnold got into office, and he started a production called the California Performance Review, which was just ill-fated in a lot of regards. It took about 8 months, Lonnie. I think about 275 state employees were involved. They produced a 2,500-page document of four volumes, 1,200 ideas. It was just too much, and it died a thousand deaths in Sacramento. Even though it polled very well, it just didn't go anywhere. But in 2003, Lonnie, there was the beginning of a conversation about government, about a dive with Arnold. It would seem to me right now in the California 2021, given just the myriad problems we see with state government, could we have a serious conversation about policy in a state that usually is not very serious about these things?
We should, Bill. I mean, I think, first of all, it's important to understand that the reason why people are upset about Gavin Newsom is not just because he keeps showing up at restaurants he shouldn't be showing up at, or because he keeps eating indoors and keeps violating the very guidance that he and his administration have set out. Yeah. Those are animating things. You know, those are things that people look at and they say, this is wrong. We got to make a change. But there are some very deep fundamental challenges that California has. And the fact is that we've been sending the same people back to Sacramento to try and solve these problems, and it's just not working. And Newsom is indicative of, I think, the kind of leadership that really hasn't been successful at tackling these fundamental problems. So what are some of them? If you look, for example, at what we're seeing with COVID, mm-hmm. the lack of transparency around decision-making, the inability to deal with special interests who are standing in the way, frankly, of what are better outcomes for people in California. Why are schools still closed? Why are businesses still shuttered? Why is it that we haven't been able to have a vaccine rollout that is as effective as those seen in other states? These are the kinds of problems that are a function of poor leadership. And poor leadership that, by the way, is easy to mask during times of plenty, but is much more challenging in times of want, like what we have now. And so I think what you're seeing, first of all, is that leadership failure, that inability to come up with making hard choices and holding people accountable that comes with, frankly, when everything is handed to you on a silver platter, which it has been for Gavin Newsom his entire career, has been for Democrats in California for their entire careers. And I think people are starting to turn around to the challenge with that. The second thing you're seeing, though, is a lack of accountability. And that is something that upsets people in California as they look at these political leaders not doing their jobs. You know, they're figuring out, you know, something might be amiss when we have a high-speed train project in California burning through billions of dollars that is still going on all these years after it started, when people had thought, didn't we get rid of that thing? But actually it still exists. And there's no accountability around the money that's spent, the no bid contracts that are handed out to various contractors to do construction that never ends up happening, that comes in over budget and behind time. That really gets people mad as well. They see an unemployment insurance system that's broken, that's delivering aid to those who don't need it. In fact, who are fraudulently trying to dupe the system instead of those who really do. That lack of accountability is something that I think gets people really, really worked up. And that also goes to why people are upset with Newsom. And then there's just the fundamental failing of addressing our basic challenges in California, like, for example, how we create a steadier flow of revenue to the state rather than the boom and bust cycles we have in California. By the way, we're in a boom cycle now, Bill. People don't realize it, but revenues in California are running ahead of what they should have been, and ahead of last year, even during a time of crisis, precisely because the stock market's doing well. And a lot of people are claiming capital gains, and capital gains taxation is the single biggest component of the personal income tax in California. So when the stock market's good, people are realizing their capital gains, they're making a lot of money, and the state makes money. But that shouldn't be the way it is. We need to create a system that's more sustainable. So none of these challenges are things, by the way, that Gavin Newsom has dealt with. And right. That's why he's in danger of being recalled, not because he ate at the French Laundry, but because he hasn't solved problems. And by the way, the other elected officials that we send to Sacramento to do their jobs clearly aren't doing them. And that's why we have the challenge we do.
Yeah. So you mentioned transparency, and that's a great point. If you, for example, want to find out, Lonnie, what the governor's economic recovery task force did for the better part of a year, this was the thing that Newsom set up. Tom Steyer, the hedge fund billionaire, former presidential candidate, headed it. They put about 100 people on it. I'm not sure how you do a Zoom call with 100 people, but that's something to figure out. Anyway, the point is, Lonnie, if you wanted to look at, if you are an investigative reporter, even a concerned citizen, and you want to look at the tapes of what they did, read the transcript, is protected by state law. So, you know, I find that kind of maddening to deal with. But I look at certain problems with the California government, Lonnie, and it just doesn't sound becoming of California. I'll give you a good example. EDD, which to those not familiar with California, stands for the Employment Development Department. That's the government, that's the entity of California trusted with doing unemployment checks. They've been accused of paying up to $31 billion in suspected unemployment fraud. At the same time, Lonnie, you have the FBI looking to whether or not the California DMV's data has been breached yet again. The last time I checked, we were the technology center of America, if not the universe. Why does our government have such crappy technology?
Well, it has bad technology, first of all, because no one is holding the government accountable for doing anything. Mm-hmm. But second of all, because policymakers really, you know, are fundamentally more interested in getting reelected than solving these basic problems. I mean, if you look at you mentioned the EDD program, which is something I referenced earlier, the state unemployment insurance plan. If you look at what's going on with the EDD, it is a disaster. It is something that taxpayers should be viscerally angry about, that you have billions of dollars in benefits being paid to those who have been committing fraud. You know, Dianne Feinstein got unemployment insurance, as it turns out. Not Dianne Feinstein, but a fraudster pretending to be Dianne Feinstein. We're sending money into prisons, knowing, by the way, that multiple unemployment insurance requests are coming from the same address. And suspiciously enough, that address happens to be a state prison. Mm-hmm. But no one pays attention to any of that. We have a program that is broken. And it's broken not because the pandemic broke it. It's broken because politicians have refused to do and make the changes that are necessary in order to make the program work better. You know, the California State Auditor looked at the unemployment insurance system in California and found that many of these problems that we're experiencing now were preventable. Mm-hmm. They were preventable through system change. They could have improved the technology. They could have done all sorts of things to ensure that the system would be prepared for the kind of stresses that we've seen over the last couple months. But, you know, politicians didn't do that. They were too busy instead, I don't know, running for re-election or something, rather than solving these basic problems. And I think that points really to the systemic challenge we have in California, which is if we keep sending the same people back to Sacramento, we're going to get the same outcomes. Right. And at some point, voters have to wake up and say, you know what, it's time for something different.
Right. So you mentioned the state auditor, Lonnie. That's a woman named Elaine Howell, who's very interesting. She has been in state government since 1983. She has held that position since 2000. Gray Davis appointed her to the job. Schwarzenegger reappointed her. Jerry Brown reappointed her. She's kind of a survivor. If you go on the state auditor's page, Lonnie, she's busy. She's churning out stuff every few days. By contrast, if you go to the page of the website of the state controller, Betty Yee, who is term limited, she's out of office in 2022. She came to that job, Lonnie, from the Board of Equalization. If you go under the press release tab of her office, she has put out 5 press releases this year. If you go to the tab, the controller of the news, there is nothing to show for 2021. I don't want to make this personal about her, but I do want to put her in the spotlight for this reason. The state controller job, Lonnie, is one of the kind of great sleeper jobs in California, I think, in this regard. The controller, for those unfamiliar with California government, charged with tracking all state spending from the Treasury, in addition to updating the public on the state's current financial state. The controller oversees 6 divisions: accounting and reporting, administration, disbursements, audits, information systems, personnel, payroll, unclaimed property. The one that stands out to me, Lonnie, is audits. And the joke, which I've been saying for years, if I had that job, I'd probably need a driver and a food taster within a matter of hours of being in Sacramento, because I would go into that job every day and play spin the wheel like Wheel of Fortune, and wherever it landed, that entity would get audited. And in a $200 billion enterprise that is the California state government, Lonnie, I imagine there's a lot you could dig into.
Well, there is. And the state controller's office is a good example of a platform from which one could say, let's begin to restore some accountability and transparency to the people's government. And that is something that the controller, that other state officials, you know, can and should be doing. That the controller's office is interesting. You mentioned audit authority. It has plenary, the state controller has plenary audit authority to audit essentially any state or local institution. And, you know, it's a very good idea. Every single day, the controller should be auditing a new agency in California, should be saying, what is this agency doing? What needs to change? What needs to improve? And by the way, the controller also has the power to say, if you're unwilling to make those changes, you don't get a budget. We're going to withhold money from you. Right. And that is something that I guarantee you will provoke people to action. You know, we have all of these levers available. Taxpayers need to be aware of the fact that there are all these levers available that people in Sacramento just aren't pulling. And really, I think the controller's office is just one example of how you could potentially use state government not to enrich a few, not to sort of send the same people back over and over again, but really to animate change in California. You know, we talk about Gavin Newsom. There's a lot of attention paid to a potential recall election because it's politically interesting. Gavin Newsom is himself an interesting character. But if you want to really make change, it really has to start with some of these other parts of the state government that can really begin to effectuate the kinds of changes and the kind of new environment in California that's needed if the state's to be successful going into this next decade and the next generation. Because if you don't make those changes now, we're going to end up with the same sort of problems and dealing with them perhaps even worse in the years to come.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, almost every year here at Hoover, Lonnie, I get a visitor. That visitor is a man or a woman who has been wildly successful in California. They're worth, you know, they have wealth to the tune of not tens, but hundreds of millions of dollars, and they're restless, and they want to run for office. And I try to talk them out of running for governor or senator. They all want to go for the shiny object, and I try to move them down ticket or into a local office. They want to buy into it. But there is a question, especially if you're a Republican running in California, how are you going to win in a state like California where Republicans Republicans, I think, are about 24.5%, I think, of voter registration right now. Last time I looked, about a 20-point gap with Democrats. You have a very suspicious public. Donald Trump is obviously a toxic character out here. How is somebody going to win a statewide election in California with the deck kind of stacked against them like that?
Well, the deck is stacked against Republicans, to be sure. And I don't think that the association with Trump is helpful.
Right.
I think it has to come back to vision and competence. And those are two themes that I do think people in California will be responsive to. You know, you can only throw Donald Trump at people so many times before their eyes glaze over and they say, okay, let's get on with the politics and let's talk about really what matters to people. Mm-hmm. And if you have candidates who are able to, first of all, articulate a vision for what they want to do, what is it that they plan to do if you give them the honor of serving the people of the state of California? What are the specific changes they intend to make? What are the ways that they intend to improve some of those themes I talked about, transparency, accountability, et cetera? If you have a vision for what that looks like, I think at some level, people have to stand up and they have to pay attention. You know, if you're able to get your message out there and to communicate it, I think that's the first thing. The second thing, though, is it goes to questions of basic competence. At some point, you know, yes, California is a very progressive state. There are parts of California that are incredibly progressive, like the part that we spend a lot of time in, Bill, here in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. But the reality is, at some point, regardless of your politics, you just want people who are competent. And I think making a basic argument about competence, about the value of sending people to state government who are actually able to do the job that the voters have put them there for, mm-hmm. I think that's a very powerful message. And I don't think it's one that goes along partisan lines. I think, in fact, it depoliticizes things more than anything else, to be able to emphasize, look, competence is fundamentally what we should demand out of people who we send to Sacramento. And one thing that's clear, given how California has been run these last several months and during the pandemic in particular, is that we don't have competent people doing these jobs. And that is something that hopefully voters will be able to look at and say, you know what? Yeah, the person's a Republican. Yeah, I don't agree with everything that they believe. I certainly don't like some of the people in their party, but that's not going to stop me from voting for someone who I think is going to be able to do the job. And I think that's going to become a more important factor as we look ahead.
Let me throw another factor at you, Lonnie, and that's the notion of a 21st century Republican Party in California, not resembling the 20th century Republican Party in California. In other words, candidates who don't necessarily look like they come straight out of the Orange County of Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan. And I'm looking in particular at someone like Young Kim, the first term congresswoman, who I think, Lonnie, is a first generation American born mm-hmm. in Korea. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, it's a great point that the coalition that a Republican would have to build statewide to be successful in California does look different. And it looks different in terms of age. It means reaching out to people who are younger, to people who are just starting their careers in California, helping them understand what it will mean if we continue to have broken policy and failed promises in this state. Going forward, what that will mean for younger people, what it will mean, you know, I think the Asian American population is one that's growing and increasingly important in California, right. Finding its political voice, particularly given, for example, the recent spate of anti-Asian violence we're seeing in California, and frankly, hatred directed at Asian Americans. It's something that more and more, I think, people with my personal background who have parents who are immigrants, who themselves are immigrants, will look at and say, you know, we have to give some voice to this. I think that's going to be an increasingly important part of a governing coalition that conservatives and Republicans might put together. And by the way, there's a tremendous number, you know, almost a million at least statewide Asian American voters who are unaffiliated, who don't have a party preference. And that creates a tremendous amount of opportunity every election to compete for those votes. So the coalition is a multicultural one. I think it's one that's younger, but fundamentally that is a coalition that can be built here in California. And it's one that I think needs to be built if we're to have true partisan competition as we once did in this state. We, for many, many years, this was a very competitive state between Republicans and Democrats. And only in the recent, you know, sort of, let's say last decade and a half, two decades, has it become so uncompetitive. And my belief, Bill, I believe this quite strongly, mm-hmm. is that California will again be competitive soon because people look at what's happening and they're going to want something different.
Okay, let's wind this down, this podcast, with a little more whimsical thought here. I just finished a column, Lottie, for Hoover. I write a weekly California column, and I pointed out that Gavin Newsom has a tricky decision coming up, and that is a decision involving baseball. And baseball is supposedly important to Newsom. He credits his ability to play baseball in college is important to his development in life. Without baseball, he's not sure he could have gone to college. But here's his challenge, Lonnie. A San Diego supervisor wants Newsom to allow a partial reopening of Petco Park on April the 1st for the home opener of the Padres. He wants 13,000 people to be able to attend. I'm not sure what Newsom's going to do there, because right now San Diego is nowhere near the so-called yellow tier, which is required to do a reopening of that size. But here's the question, Lonnie. Here's a governor who may be looking at a recall. Let's say he grants the Padres a favor and allows Petco Park to open up. What are the Dodgers going to do? The Dodgers are going to want to reopen up on April the 9th. The Angels will want to open up and have their crowds in. Go further to the north. The Giants are going to want to reopen. The A's are going to reopen. And so now here's a governor looking at a recall who has to decide where the votes are. But also, Lonnie, it's that most troublesome of Democratic problems, equality and equity. The Dodgers and Padres are baseball royalty. The Giants and the Angels, not so much. What's this governor going to do?
It wouldn't surprise me if he made the decision to open everything up. In other words, all of these baseball teams will be able to have, diminished capacity. So, as you say, maybe 20%, which is about 10 to 13,000 people in most of these stadiums, to go ahead and open that up for opening day, which is coming up in April. You know, as California continues to make gains against coronavirus, as does the rest of the country, more and more people get vaccinated. Hopefully we can pick up the pace in California. I do think that there is a hopefulness around being able to do this. But you know what? Here's the thing. It shouldn't have to take a bunch of, just to use youth athletics as an example, because I've got a son who's of the age where he's playing youth athletics. It's very important to him. It shouldn't have to take a bunch of parents and a bunch of youth players expressing just how devastating it's been to not have this outlet. It shouldn't take that for a governor to stand up and realize this is an important priority for people to be able to have expressions like this, to be able to get out and play. And whether it's youth athletics or professional athletics, this is an important part of people's lives. And we shouldn't just diminish it as, oh, it's a game. It's, whatever. They'll get over it if they don't have sports. The reality is this speaks to a bigger challenge we have. And so I hope the governor does allow, folks into outdoor stadiums, proper social distancing, mask wearing, et cetera, of course. Right. But I hope he does allow people to go and catch a baseball game for the first time in a year, because that is part of what we really need, I think, to begin to climb this long road to recovery and to get back to a place where people feel like they can live their lives. And, baseball is a big part of that. I'm a baseball fan. You are too, Bill, but not just baseball, other sports as well, but baseball in particular, because it's outdoors and because there's a way to do it safely. We've seen it in other states. We're seeing it in Arizona and Florida now with spring training. So we do have a guide on how to do this.
Okay. Final question. I'll let you go, my friend. Are you bullish or bearish on the Lakers these days?
I tend to be a glass half empty guy when it comes to the Lakers. So when they lost four in a row recently, I was pretty despondent, but I think they'll be okay. I think veteran leadership, it'll be a very competitive stretch run here, but I like the Lakers back to back. And, I say that as a native Los Angelino, but also as somebody who now is in enemy territory here in the Bay Area with lots of Warriors fans, but I like the Lakers' chances.
Yeah, just don't drive around with your flags if they win the championship again.
Try not to do that. Yeah,
it's so California annoying. But by the way, I don't know if you saw it. LeBron James got some heat from an athlete in Sweden who said that LeBron should get out of politics. And LeBron apparently didn't like that.
He had a very smart response. He'd done his work. We talk about, in politics, making sure you understand who your opponent is. He clearly understood, because he had a very effective response for the Swedish soccer player, basically saying, actually, weren't you the one who yourself went through a period of racial discrimination? And wouldn't you have wanted to speak out about it? In fact, didn't you? So I thought LeBron had a very effective response.
So maybe that's where Republicans need to turn for messaging. They have to go to the king.
That's right. That's right. Well, it's better than anyone else they've been turning to recently, probably.
Okay. Well, on that note, we're going to cut it off. Lonnie, enjoyed the conversation. Keep doing the great work you do, and keep us posted on how 2024 is shaking down for Republicans. I'm very curious as to what their path is moving forward.
Thanks, Bill. So am I.
You've been listening to Matters of Policy and Politics, a Hoover Institution podcast devoted to governance and balance of power here in America and around the world. If you enjoyed this conversation, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. While you're at it, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Institution's Daily Report, which delivers the latest from Lonnie Chen and his colleagues straight to your inbox weekdays. Very easy to do that. You just go to hoover.org, click on the Publications tab. You'll see a subscribe button at the top of the page, which will get you the Daily Report. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's spelled at Hoover, I-N-S-T. Lonnie Chen, brave man that he is also on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at Lonnie Chen. That is spelled L-A-N-H-E-E-C-H-E-N. We'll have a new podcast for you later this week. We're going to go over to Europe and talk about change in leadership, which means a wiedersehen, Chancellor Merkel, bonjour, Prime Minister Macron. Until then, stay safe, stay healthy, and we'll do our best here at the Hoover Institution to help you stay informed. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution, where we advance ideas that define a free society. For more information about our work and to hear more of our podcasts or see our video content, please visit hoover.org.